Thank you for joining us.
Okay, so we're going to turn now to three talks on the church touring thesis. And it's my great pleasure to introduce, where are you, Wilfred? Wilfred Zieg. Come on up. Wilfred is professor at Carnegie Mellon of philosophy and a very well-known scholar of Hilbert, Gödel, church, touring, many things. I can mention, among many other papers, the we hope soon to be forthcoming edition of Hilbert's lecture notes. Among other things, we learn how early first-order logic was taken out of higher-order logic from these works. And the other is a collected set of essays from Oxford University Press on the history and philosophy of mathematics. I'm not sure what the title of that is.
Hilbert Programs and Beyond.
Hilbert Programs and Beyond. So that is what he's an expert. So normal forms for puzzles, an enigmatic variant of Turing.
Perhaps you should first try it, because I remember from the previous speaker it was sort of noisy when it was...
Yeah, that's
better?
Okay.
So anyway, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation to join you. I have no direct contact with Turing, only indirect. I got to know Robin Gandy quite well, and you will see that he has been quite influential for my own work in these matters. Like this? Is that better? Okay. In any event, Turing has been one of my intellectual heroes ever since the 1980s. When I started to analyze his computability notion. His results and mathematical techniques clearly impressed me, but I found and still find most impressive his open and experimental spirit, his way of articulating difficult issues in vivid, informal language. That is the only photo. These characteristics, that is, articulating problems of a significant character in informal vivid language, are also found in the paper solvable and unsolvable problems in which Turing formulated the enigmatic variant of his thesis alluded to in the title of my talk. This paper, presumably Turing's last publication, appeared in 1954 in the journal Science News. Turing's paper focuses on the methodological problems surrounding calculability, Church's Turing's thesis, and argues for the adequacy of a rigorous notion of computability without ever mentioning his machines. That may be surprising. After all, for Church, Gödel, and many contemporary computer scientists, it is the analysis of mechanical procedures in terms of finite machines that makes Turing's work so convincing. Instead of machines, Turing uses unambiguous substitution puzzles as the basic concept in this paper. There are four parts to my talk. In the first, I would like to explain what substitution puzzles are so that you are not puzzled about that very notion. Then I discuss very traditionally the efforts surrounding calculable functions and giving a characterization thereof, mechanical procedures, and then discrete dynamical systems. So the enigmatic variant of Turing's thesis is articulated by Turing in this paper as follows. Given any puzzle, we can find a corresponding substitution puzzle, which is equivalent to it in the sense that given a solution of the one, we can easily find a solution of the other. and you still may be puzzled, because I didn't explain what puzzles are, and I still didn't explain what substitution puzzles are. But in any event, this statement that any puzzle has a substitution puzzle as its normal or standard form, as Turing puts it, is, so Turing again, still somewhat lacking in definiteness, and will remain so. He views this not quite definite statement as being situated between the theorem and the definition, and he explains that as follows. Insofar as we know a priori what is a puzzle and what is not, the statement is a theorem. Insofar as we do not know what puzzles are, the statement is a definition that tells us something about what they are. Let's look at some of Turing's examples of puzzles. He considers three-dimensional knots and transformations to turn them into different sorts of knots. Two-dimensional sliding squares, you know, you have a square with little tiles in it and you can push them around in the appropriate way. And then one-dimensional substitution puzzles. For the latter kind, one has an unlimited supply of counters, possibly of only two distinct kinds. An initial configuration is a finite sequence of such counters, and the puzzle task is to transform the given configuration into another one by substitutions from a fixed finite list. So you have unlimited supply of counters, little squares, initial configuration, the finite sequence of such, you have a fixed list of substitutions, and you can turn one configuration to another following these rules that are articulated through substitutions. A good example of a substitution puzzle is, so Turing, that is more than just a toy, is the task of proving a mathematical theorem within an axiomatic system. Indeed, one of the most important issues in mathematical logic during the 1920s concerned this very puzzle for first-order logic. The question was, is it solvable by mechanical procedures? It is Hilbert's Entscheidungsproblem. Commenting on this problem in 1926, von Neumann conjectured that it must have a negative solution, but added, we have absolutely no idea on how to prove this. 10 years later, Turing showed that the problem is indeed unsolvable. And he addressed, first of all, the key conceptual problem of giving a precise explication to mechanical procedure by his machine model of computation. And then he showed the unsolvability of the Horting problem, or printing problem, and finally reduced the decision problem to it. He used his method, also in 1950, to establish the unsolvability of another problem. However, he remarked at the beginning of that paper the method that is not the intelligent machinery intelligence paper, it's a purely mathematical paper. The method depends on reducing the unsolvability of a problem in question to a known unsolvable problem connected with the logical computing machines introduced by Post and the author. I put in bold letters the part which, when I first read it, I found quite striking. And I still think it is a striking way of acknowledging Post's influence on Turing's work at that time, pointing to the structural similarity between Turing's own two-letter machines and the worker of Post 1936. Indeed, if you look at Post's paper, Post's worker operates in a symbol space that consists of a two-way potentially infinite sequence of marked and unmarked boxes. The worker can perform a number of primitive acts. He or she can mark or unmark a box, move from one box to the immediately next adjacent box to the right or to the left, and determine whether the box he is in is marked or not. When carrying out a procedure, the worker follows a finite numbered sequence of instructions. Just remember the picture of Turing's two-letter machine we saw a number of times. This is a different way of describing exactly the same general model of computation. Post gave no intrinsic reasons for this formulation, but in the background is his extensive work from the 1920s on production systems and their normal forms. That work was published only in 1943. Now, Post described in a paper that was published in 1947 Turing machines via production system in the way in which Martin Davis describes them in his classical book, very elegantly, and proved the word problem for semigroups to be unsolvable. 3 years later, Turing used Post's general approach to extend the unsolvability result from semigroups to semigroups with cancellation. This concrete mathematical work is part of the reason, I think, why Turing, 1954, exposes his fundamental considerations on computability via substitution puzzles. I conjecture that the main reason is the stunning conceptual confluence of his work with Post's that is acknowledged by Turing in the opening remark I quoted. I'll come back to this deeper conceptual confluence when describing Turing's 1936 analysis that differs so radically from the contemporaneous discussion of calculable number theoretic functions. And that's what I want to turn to next. Calculable functions. Turing's earlier remarks I quoted concerning the peculiar status of the statement he made connecting puzzles with substitution puzzles give a hint of his perspective on the methodological status of his thesis. The thoughts of other logicians like Hilbert, Bernays, Abraham, Gödel were not proceeding at all along those lines, but were informed by paradigmatic recursive procedures for calculating the values of number theoretic functions. Dedekind, as you know, had introduced primitive recursive functions in a way in his 1880 essay on the nature and meaning of numbers. Hilbert and Bernays used primitive recursive functions in the 1920s with a deeply computational perspective. Abraham expanded that class on Gödel, built on that work when introducing general recursive functions in his lectures he gave in 1934 at Princeton. Church's thesis, as it was formulated for the first time in 1935, identifies calculable number theoretic functions with the general recursive ones. And this identification is supported by Church and others by quasi-empirical evidence. We don't know of any effectively calculable function that is not general recursive, and the proven equivalence of different notions. And for Church, that was the equivalence between lambda definability and general recursiveness. I would like to focus, in contrast, not on these two types of arguments, but rather on attempts to argue directly, and in a certain sense, prove the relationship between effective calculability in terms of one central concept, namely calculation in a logic. Now, you might be surprised about this, but there's, first of all, Church, 1936. He introduced, as a matter of fact, in a section of this paper where he tries to prove that every effectively calculable function is general recursive, the notion of calculable in a logic. And this Kalkbrenner logic is in a certain sense a generalization of Gödel's equational calculus. Not just equational reasoning as a lot, but any form of reasoning. Gödel tries to do a similar thing in 1936, the paper that was mentioned by Julia Kennedy. And in 1946, when he discusses the absoluteness of the notion of general recursiveness. And Hilbert and Bernays, in a supplement to the second volume of The Foundations of Mathematics, give a detailed analysis of what they call regelrecht auswertbare Funktionen, reckonable functions. Okay? So let me make a few remarks. I made already a remark about Church. And so, an unphilic function is effectively calculable, by definition, if its values can be calculated in appropriate logic. And the calculation has to proceed stepwise. And if, as a matter of fact, these steps are recursive, then, of course, the function you started out with is recursive. But why, for heaven's sake, should the steps be recursive? Church does not give an argument for that. But rather, in a footnote, he remarks, what else could it mean but recursiveness? That's all. So I suppose, in a certain way, there is an interesting analysis of calculability as calculability in a calculus, but also a subtle circularity in requiring that the steps have to be recursive. Gödel, in 1936, argued that general recursive functions are absolute. And he did this for higher order arithmetic, either finite or transfinite type theories. And the claim was that if you can calculate the value of a function at a very high type, you can do it already at the very bottom part. And if you look at the particular theory you're looking at, then there's not a problem because all the computation steps are primitive recursive. So, as in the Church step-by-step argument, you know the function is, as a matter of fact, recursive. Now, in 1946, he tried to do something quite different. Namely, he looked at any formal theory that extends number theory, and then tries to articulate exactly the same fact, namely, if you can calculate the value of function in such an extension, then you can do it already in number theory. And there, of course, he intended to give reasons for why general recursiveness could be used to explicate formality. That, of course, cannot be done. There is exactly the same kind of circularity. You can't establish the absoluteness claim unless you take already for granted that you are dealing with a form of theory in a very precise sense, namely that steps are recursive in some form or shape. In any event, so let me jump across a little bit so that I don't run completely out of time. But this I should mention, Church's central thesis, not the broad thesis, every effective in calculable function is generally recursive, but rather that the elementary steps in calculations must be recursive. Part C, mechanical procedures. And how do we get there? I suppose when looking back at mathematical problems and the conceptual issues that had to be addressed, one notices that they are hardly concerned with such number theoretic calculations. They also seem to have nothing in common with operations of a Turing machine or the wanderings of a post-worker. Well, let's examine that claim by reviewing Turing's 1936 analysis of mechanical procedures. That's how we get to mechanical procedures. And just as a footnote, I would like to emphasize there is an emphasis on human computability, as was pointed out a number of times. And if you look at the intellectual context in which that work was supposed to be done, that's exactly the right thing to do. The decision problem was supposed to be solved by us, not by some fancy machine or other. The formality that was exploited to to make sure that we have a way of checking proofs in a theory on a very elementary cognitive basis. That was also formulated for us, not for some other fancy being. Okay. So to focus on human computability is exactly the right thing to do. So that's what Urey emphasized at the very outset, that he is concerned with mechanical operations on symbolic configurations carried out by humans. Indeed, he uses computer throughout his paper for a human computing agent who proceeds mechanically. His machines, our Turing machines, are referred to just as machines. Gandhi suggested calling a computer, in Turing's sense, a computer, and a computing machine, as we do now, a computer. The symbolic configurations on which computers operate have been written on paper that is divided into squares like a child's arithmetic book. So, Turing. However, the two-dimensional character of the paper is not viewed to be an essential of computation, and the one-dimensional tape divided into squares is taken as the basic computing space. Okay, so post boxes, Turing squares. When striving then to isolate computer operations that are so elementary that it is not easy to imagine them further divided, Turing formulates one crucial requirement, namely that symbolic configurations relevant for a computer's actions have to be recognized immediately or at a glance. Because just put yourself in the position that you couldn't do this, then you would have to carry out a subcomputation to see that this particular symbolic configuration or particular character on which you are acting. Because of the reductive step to a linear tape, one has to be concerned only with the immediate recognizability of finite sequences of symbols. Turing appeals now to a very crude empirical fact. It is impossible for a computer to determine at a glance whether or not this numeral is identical with, and now test yourself. I flash another one on, and you have to tell me, do you recognize immediately that those two strings are the same one? Immediately, yes or no? Well, did you do this immediately, or did it take a little bit of time? And if this is not long enough, undoubtedly I can stretch it out a little bit and it will be more difficult for you. But in any event, so that is a very crude empirical fact of which Turing appears, and I think that's the charm of it, that it is so crude and so obvious. In any event, the computer's sensory limitation leads directly to boundedness and locality conditions, namely, that there is a bound on the number of symbol sequences a computer can recognize immediately or at a glance, and that the operations of a computer must locally modify a recognized configuration. Given this restrictive analysis, this section 9 of Turing's paper, so with a little bit of modification, simplification, that's exactly how Turing tried to argue. Given this restrictive analysis of a computer's steps, it is evident that, first of all, Turing machines that operate on strings, string machines, simulate directly computers. String machines, as Robin Gandhi articulated this, appear as a codification of his, Turing's analysis of calculations by humans. And finally, string machines are substitution puzzles, and the latter are a species of post-production systems. And it is, I think, this remarkable confluence that post came to production systems and normal forms for them. And the analysis of Turing, they're exactly the same. It's stunning. This conceptual confluence is not just some sort of equivalence between calculability, recursiveness, and, say, lambda definability, or recursiveness and Turing machine computability. It's the same notion. That's why I think this is so interesting and important. There is a genuine conceptual confluence. Certain moment. Okay. Yeah, so what I would like to say and emphasize is that the argument from 1936 leads in natural steps from human mechanical procedures to those of string machines, but it is not a mathematical proof. Just as a side note, Robin Gandhi thought there is a proof there of a particular sort, but there is a proof. I don't think so. But be that as it may. Turing himself views it as mathematically unsatisfactory because it relies on an appeal to intuition. However, an appeal to intuition is no longer needed for the thesis that every mechanical procedure can be carried out by a computing machine of this restricted character, but only for a more restricted judgment. The mechanical procedures of computers can be carried out of out on strings without loss of generality. Let me call this judgment Turing's central thesis. And it's similar to Church's central thesis in that you are joining an informal concept, here symbolic configuration, with a precise mathematical notion, strings. Allowing larger classes of properly mathematical configuration makes Turing's central thesis inductively more convincing. For example, Kolmogorov and Uspensky considered in 1963 particular kinds of graphs. Pardon me? That's the translation, 63. And I refer to the translation, so I don't know about the real origin. In any event, they introduced particular kinds of graphs, and with my student John Burns, I generalized them further to K-graphs, a particular kind of graph. And so you have generalization. You're not just operating on strings, but you have production rules on such graphs that you make replacements of the appropriate character. However, an appeal to the central thesis can't be avoided, and that may have been the reason why Turing thought that the variant of his thesis must remain indefinite, and that this very statement is one which one does not attempt to prove. I agree, but I also think that one can do better than what Turing suggested, namely to resort to propaganda. So, that leads me to the last part of my talk. The better way involves the introduction of a more abstract concept of computable processes. Analogous steps have been taken in 19th century mathematics. A pertinent example is found already in Dedekind's essay on continuity and irrational numbers. He discusses there, in the very beginning, the rational numbers with their standard ordering, satisfying transitivity, density, and the cut property. And he does this for the rational numbers, he does this for geometric line, and then he introduces a new notion of an ordered system. That is, O, a particular system set, is an ordered system if and only if there is a relation on O satisfy these conditions. So obviously, the two earlier concrete notions, that is, the ordering of the rational numbers and those of the geometric line, are falling under this more general concept. There is an abundance of such structural definitions, groups, spheres, topological spaces, and they reflect the move of modern mathematics to greater abstraction. Let us see where we stand with respect to mechanical processes. Let S be a set of finite strings over some alphabet, and a function from S to S is computable, S computable, if and only if there is a string machine such that the value of F for any argument is determined by a computation of that machine. And if you remember that string machines and post-production systems are the same, then this next step I'm going to suggest is almost immediate, namely now you're no longer looking at strings, but at k-graphs, and you can call the function from k-graphs to k-graphs k-computable, if and only if there are finitely many k-transitions such that the value of psi for any argument is determined by a computation following the rules. And there is an obvious equivalence theorem, namely that these two notions are the same. That is, any k-computable function psi is s-computable, and for the other direction we just have to remember what I mentioned earlier, that s-transition rules specify string machines. The question is, can we get away from considering special kinds of configurations? As a step towards that aim, I reformulate the informal requirements for computers. They operate on configurations that are finite, but of unbounded size. They can recognize in each configuration a unique pattern of a fixed bounded list. They locally operate on the pattern recognized in a given configuration. And finally, they assemble the next configuration from the original one and the result of the local operation. These requirements can be formulated as defining or characteristic conditions for computable discrete dynamical systems. So consider a discrete dynamical system with state space S consisting of hereditarily finite sets and an operation F. The dynamical system is called computable if the operation F is computable. And F is computable if and only if there are finitely many patterns and local operations on them such that the value of F for any argument is determined by a computation via the local operations. And one can prove a representation theorem, namely, if you look at any particular computable dynamical system, it can be simulated by a Turing machine. Okay. So the question is, what has been achieved? The methodological problems surrounding the thesis have been lifted from their unusual status in mathematics. That has been achieved through the definition of computable discrete dynamical systems, thus of computable discrete dynamical systems. Hilbert called such characteristic defining conditions for a structure axioms. And so do we when talking about the axioms for groups or rings or topological spaces. In that sense, I have given an axiomatic analysis of mechanical procedures that can be carried out by a computer. Building only on very natural boundedness and locality conditions. Though the methodological problem has not been removed, it has been deeply transformed. Now they concern axioms, no longer statements whose status is somewhere between a definition and a theorem. They are no longer unusual, but rather common and difficult, as they ask us to assess the correctness and appropriateness of axioms for an intended, albeit abstract, concept. The central role Turing machines play in the theory of calculability, that is, Turing's two-letter machines and post workers is secured by the representation theorem. Thank you very much.
Seven minutes for questions, so I think
Philip
wants to field his own questions.
I field my own questions, yes. Wow. My questions. Wow. Okay. But I'm also happy to field your questions, and I hope you have some. Juliet, yes?
Yeah, so I have two questions. So the footnote in the...
One at a time.
So the footnote in Gödel's 1946,
right,
explicating this broadened absolute mistake,
right,
he says a function is absolute if it is representable in an extension, then the representation already lives in the ground theory. So he uses the word representation. He doesn't say if it's computable in an extension.
But there has to be a computable term that represents it. So there's a calculation that is associated with it. So there's no question about it.
So you're saying that the question whether it halts or not is, I mean, the claim is that if it halts in an extension, it has to halt in the it halts in the ground.
Yes.
Theory that that's the.
Yeah. So the calculation that can be carried out at the somewhere in this extension,
yeah,
be it higher order. Arithmetic or
yeah,
set theory with strong axioms of infinity,
right,
who cares? If it can be calculated there, it can be calculated in arithmetic.
So you don't see any distinction between a calculable term representing the function and the calculation of a value of the function? I mean, that a term represents the function by numerability, which even in Q, very weak theories, you have, I think, binumerability, representability, if the function has halts on a value or if it doesn't halt on a value. This can be expressed, but whether the theory is strong enough to prove that the function halts on that value, that's a, I just thought that was...
Now, see, I don't think it's a matter of deciding the halting problem in some form or other. It's a question of that you have a calculation. Whether it holds or not doesn't matter in a certain way.
Right, okay, so...
But if you can do it in the extension of arithmetic, then it can be done already in...
Oh, okay, but the calculation or the representation of the function?
Look, I mean, I don't remember the precise formulation.
Okay.
So I would think that the representation has to be already at the bottom part.
Yes. Okay. So we'll I'll save my other question for the break.
Okay. Yes.
I'm Harry Lewis. I read a paper by Yuri Gurevich a couple of years ago about proving the Turing thesis based on some reduction of the computations and so on. Are you familiar with that? Can you relate it to what you've just laid out?
Yes, I examined this paper as much in great detail, and I corresponded with Yuri and Dershowitz about it. I don't think there is a proof in any sense of the word. And you appeal to something like the central thesis with respect to abstract state machines. And if you do this, then of course you can establish it. But there is still a thesis to it.
Also,
but I'm happy. I wrote an analysis of it. I'm happy to send it.
I'm not suggesting that I disagree with you at all. I simply asked the question.
No.
I have a comment on this because I'm really curious about several problems. What he's doing with his model is really no different from what one side did in analytic logic, and I don't know why.
But I mean, there is a strong claim that Church's thesis has been proved. Yeah.
Any other questions? If not, then let's thank the speaker and.